From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the man behind Ronald Reagan's 1984 landslide victory over Walter Mondale. Ed Rollins has been described as a super consultant for the Republican Party, on par with his Democrat counterpart, James Carville. Rollins, once a Democrat, went on to manage the campaigns of some of the most powerful Republican candidates. Now retired, he looks back on his more than 30 years in American politics. Also, we'll hear the story of one man's obsession with a Seattle band. The story comes to us from the new public radio program, This American Life. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Senior State Department officials reportedly will meet this afternoon with European Union representatives who plan to file a formal protest regarding the new U.S. sanctions law on investment in Iran and Libya. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Even before President Clinton signed the new law on Monday, European allies had expressed their displeasure very clearly. They threatened retaliatory action if the U.S. implemented the measure. It's designed to punish countries that the U.S. says are principal state sponsors of terrorism. The law, known as the D'Amato Law, imposes sanctions on foreign companies that make new investments of $40 million in either oil or gas projects in Iran or Libya. U.S. allies maintain the law amounts to a violation of their sovereignty. State Department sources say today's meeting will be attended by representatives of the European Commission delegation here in Washington and the presidency of the European Union. I'm Vicky O'Hara in Washington.
British troops have set up barbed wire and barricades in Londonderry along the route of a Protestant march set for Saturday. The security measures have made part of the route impassable, the part along the Catholic Bogside neighborhood. Officials fear a repeat of the widespread violence started by a Protestant march last month. There will not be a floor fight on abortion at next week's Republican Party convention in San Diego. Abortion rights supporters were threatening to open up the platform and debate the issue. But late yesterday, a deal was announced between GOP officials and the abortion rights activists in their party. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Since 1980, the Republican platform has called for a constitutional amendment outlawing abortion. But opinion polls indicate that the majority of Republican voters do not support a ban. And California Governor Pete Wilson, Massachusetts Governor William Weld, and Senator Olympia Snow of Maine threatened to lead a floor fight at the convention if the platform did not recognize the views of Republicans who support abortion rights. GOP officials avoided that fight by agreeing to publish the failed platform proposals of abortion rights advocates and distribute it at the convention along with the platform. The minority report won't just be about abortion, however. It will contain every amendment that was defeated during the three-day meeting, regardless of the topic. One abortion rights lobbyist said of the deal, "This year, at this time, it was the best we could get done." I'm Ina Jaffe in San Diego.
The number of first-time claims for jobless benefits jumped by 24,000 last week, but remained well below the 370,000 level reached earlier this summer. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 19.23 in light trading of 148 million shares. This is National Public Radio News. Chechen rebels are struggling for control of the capital, Grozny, as Russian tanks and soldiers advanced on the city. The military command says in the past 3 days of fighting, 70 Russian servicemen have died and about 300 have been injured. It's estimated that 200 rebels have also died. Tomorrow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin will be inaugurated to a second term. His spokesman said that shortly after the ceremony, he'll leave for a long vacation. Workers of Argentina's major unions are on strike today to protest recent social spending cuts and chronic high unemployment. NPR's Nina Teicholz reports.
Argentina's largest trade union, the CGT, called for the strike after the government announced its latest belt-tightening measures last month, a cut in family allowances and the end of tax breaks for food vouchers. These bitter pills were the last straw for many Argentines, of whom more than 17% are unemployed. Middle-class people slipping into poverty, Roman Catholic bishops, and the political opposition have sharply criticized the government. They say its economic policies put fiscal discipline ahead of social welfare. Due to these pressures, in part, President Carlos Menem fired his finance minister some 2 weeks ago, but critics were not appeased. The CGT trade union president, General Gerardo Martinez, said today's strike will be the first of many if economic policies don't change. This is Nina Teicholz reporting.
Hundreds of travelers are stranded because of a dispute between the United States and Venezuela. Most flights between the two countries have been canceled. Neither government is explaining exactly why, but it has something to do with recent U.S. rulings that Venezuela must tighten its airline safety procedures. Government warplanes and artillery pounded rebel positions today in Sri Lanka, attempting to crack the guerrillas' fierce defense of their largest stronghold. I'm Doreen McAllister, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. Republican strategist Ed Rollins is all over the papers these days with refreshingly frank quotes attacking many of his former employers. He calls New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman's husband and brother, who worked on her campaign, cocky, pompous, and abrasive. He says Ross Perot was an extremely dangerous demagogue with delusions of adequacy. But Rollins writes, Perot was a saint compared to Michael and Arianna Huffington. He calls her a wily sorceress and the most ruthless, unscrupulous, and ambitious person he'd ever met in national politics. Michael Huffington, who tried to unseat California Senator Dianne Feinstein, is described as colorless, talentless, boring. Rollins is saying goodbye to politics after a career as one of the Republican Party's most admired campaign strategists. He managed Ronald Reagan's landslide victory over Walter Mondale in 1984 and Christine Todd Whitman's upset victory for governor of New Jersey in 1994. But at the end of that campaign, Rollins committed political suicide when he told the press that the Whitman campaign had given money to black ministers to dissuade their congregations from voting. He has since apologized and said he had no evidence for his statement. Rollins' swan song to politics is all laid out in his new book, Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms. In the book, Rollins says he didn't start out as a Republican. He was a Bobby Kennedy supporter. I asked him what changed his mind.
George McGovern, I clearly saw the change the leftward shift of the Democratic Party. McGovern sort of epitomized that for me in 1972, and when he became the nominee, I changed my party registration and worked for Nixon. I just thought the party was no longer related to the values that I had and no longer really represented me. I often said, who left who? In 1960, John Kennedy was elected to the White House, was the first president that I really followed closely and supported. He was for strong national defense and cutting taxes and basically deregulating government. 20 years later, I was in Reagan's White House as the White House political director, and he was for strong national defense, cutting taxes, and smaller government. So I don't know who moved. My sense is the Democratic Party moved leftward in the 60s and 70s. And I moved a little bit more to the center and center-right, and I found much comfort in the Republican Party.
You were asked to be part of the Reagan White House in his first term. What was your job?
I was the first year I was the deputy political director. The second year I was the White House assistant to the president, which is the top level of the White House for political affairs. Served there through the end of 1983. When Reagan asked me to go run his campaign, which I left the White House and went out and managed the 84 reelection campaign, then went back in the White House in the second term as the assistant to the president for political affairs and governmental affairs, which is handling all the mayors, all the governors, all the state legislators around the country.
Well, you describe working in that White House 10 to 12-hour days, 7 days a week. What takes so much time? And we're talking about 70 to 80 hours a week of work.
Well, that was a minimum work week. I mean, there were many days I was there literally from 7 in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. A White House is the final stop. I mean, it's where all the crises come. Every decision that's difficult in the government gets eventually shifted to the White House. The easier decisions are all decided somewhere else. So you obviously are involved in a lot of meetings. You're involved in many crises. You don't get to control your own agenda or your own time. And the White House staffs are very small. I mean, there's probably a president may have 300 people totally that work for him in a White House, and there may be 20 or 30 people that really matter. My responsibility was for, as I stated earlier, all the governors across the country, every legislator across the country, every major city mayor, every political figure in the country who wanted to deal with the White House had to deal with me first. You know, they obviously couldn't talk to the president every day, so they had to call my office and deal with me. And, you know, and obviously people don't call the White House unless they want something or in some sort of crisis.
So could you ever go home and shut the door to your office and not think about work and think, okay, everything's taken care of and now I can go to the movies and out to dinner and relax?
No, you couldn't, because first of all, you go home and there's a White House telephone in your, which the White House operator would be able to get you 24 hours a day. And oftentimes you'd be woken at 3 o'clock in the morning, there'd be a crisis somewhere in the world that'd notify you of the crisis. Not that you necessarily had responsibility for that crisis, but they just kept you informed. You never get away from it. I mean, it literally is a seven-day-a-week job, and there's a burnout. At the end of 5 years, when I finally left the White House, you know, I had aged dramatically. You know, and it just, it's no one can do it for much beyond that. And I think the reality is it's a great experience. It's the most incredible experience anybody can possibly have. But it does beat you down, and the tension beats you down, and you know, after a while, you're just, people used to always say to me, did you feel powerful when you're in the White House? I said, the only thing I ever felt when I was in the White House was exhausted. Mm. I was constantly exhausted.
You had a stroke.
I had a stroke in 1982. A week before the elections, I literally had a stroke that fortunately didn't prove fatal and didn't prove to be one that did too much damage, but I always thought I was kind of indestructible. I had never really taken a vacation. I had worked, as I said, the kind of pace I had. I had been traveling everywhere with the president on the campaign trail, and then I was, George Duke Majan was running for governor of California, Pete Wilson running for the Senate. We're old friends of mine, so I made three red-eye trips back to California. We'd get picked up at Dulles, go out to Andrews and fly off, and I was running on about 3 or 4 hours sleep, and an old injury that I had received when I was boxing, a clot had formed in my carotid artery, and it broke off, and obviously suffered a stroke.
Mm. You think it was work-related, stress-related, or it was just
Blood pressure was high, you know, I was not to say it wouldn't have happened doing something else, but fortunately it didn't kill me. But it did make me become a little more reflective, and it also made me decide I needed to take vacations when I was tired or lay down, and I started taking Sundays off. I started basically working six-day work weeks instead of seven.
Ed Rollins is our guest, a Republican campaign manager, political consultant. He has a new book called Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms about his many years managing and being part of campaigns and White Houses. The way you describe some of the inner workings of the Reagan White House, it sounds like kind of an episode in a soap opera. Lots of infighting, intrigue, accusations, rumor control, turf battles. Do you think that's typical for most White Houses?
I think every White House has a lot of Type A players who are all struggling for power. It's the ultimate power place, and you're obviously always struggling to have the ear of the president. The Reagan White House was complicated even more so by the fact that Reagan, which I question somewhat in his book, chose the person who had run against him, George Bush, and many of the people who had opposed him in both 76 and 80 to come into his White House, Jim Baker being the most obvious example, who was the chief of staff. So what you had is you had a guy like Baker who was very much a pragmatist, who didn't really believe in Reagan's programs, that fought it as economic programs and other programs, versus Ed Meese, who had been the president's chief of staff when he was governor of California, one of his closest allies, who philosophically was very in tune with Reagan. And so you constantly had this sort of offsetting power centers. And the difference between a power struggle in the White House and, say, a power struggle in a corporation or some other outside entity is that there's such national media scrutiny. So Jim Baker was a very effective leaker. I mean, he was probably the principal leaker in the White House. And, you know, he'd always tell his story to the reporters. And Meese wasn't very good at that and didn't want to do that. So there was always stories of disarray and conflict. I think the true thing is that Reagan himself may have even been better served by the conflicts, because no decisions could be made by any of the individuals who were outside the Oval Office. They had to bring the decisions to him, and he in turn had to make them, unlike when Don Regan was the chief of staff in the second term, and there really were only Regan people there by the end. He would make a lot of the decisions and bring them to the president sort of as completed, accomplished things, where, in essence, the first term, the debate, the dialogue always went in front of the president.
You have a great deal of admiration for Ronald Reagan, and you also write that even though he had fantastic people skills, he was, your words, at heart a loner and had mm-hmm. no friends of his own. The friends that he had seemed to be friends of his wife. What was your relationship with Ronald Reagan?
I was not a longtime insider. I came out of California, and obviously having spent a lot of years working for him, I became, you know, I knew him well. But when I say Reagan was a loner, I don't mean that in a detrimental way. I think he was very comfortable with himself. He was the most secure man I've ever known in my life.
Really?
Yes. He had all of his ego needs taken care of. He was not out to try and prove anything. He just wanted to serve his country and serve his country effectively. And I shouldn't say he had no friends. He certainly had some close friends. Senator Paul Axalt was a close friend and some others. But he didn't need friends in the way that other people do. I mean, Ronald Reagan was very happy with his own company. He was very happy on his ranch by himself, chopping wood with one or two workers out there. He didn't need all the social glitz. He was very good at it. I mean, he could sit down and charm you on any given day. Mrs. Reagan was very much into friends, and she worked friends and was on the telephone constantly. And Reagan was not someone who would every day say, gee, I need to talk to these 10 people who are my friends just to keep in touch. He just sort of did what he had to do. And as I said, he was a very secure man.
Well, talking about Nancy Reagan, you write, no one could unnerve me like Nancy. Were you scared of her?
Yeah, I was. It was amazing for a guy that's had as many fights as I had and didn't intimidate around men. As one of my White House colleagues said to me one day, she smells fear all over. There was something about her that unnerved me, and I'm sure she sensed that. It wasn't that she wasn't always. I mean, there were times that we had conflicts, but the truth of the matter is just. I didn't quite fit her mole. I mean, I was not a great dresser. I'm kind of a sloppy guy. I'm kind of a blue collar guy, and she clearly was not as much into that as some others might be. But I will say this for Nancy Reagan: Ronald Reagan probably wouldn't have been president. Certainly wouldn't have served two terms without her support, undying support. She was his confidant. She was his closest friend. She was the person who had a very protective instinct about her. She wanted to protect him, where, you know, he wasn't a paranoid guy. He wasn't worried about whether people were serving him well or not. I mean, he just expected everybody to do their job, and he wouldn't get mad at people. He wouldn't yell and scream at people. And she got frustrated by that sometimes because she thought some people were out for their own good as opposed to his good. She had great PR instincts and great political instincts. I would say he had great people instincts in the sense that he always knew where the country was. He had very little interest in the day-to-day elements of politics, who the National Committee people were or who precinct chairmen were or any of that was not relevant to him. But he always knew where the great body politic was. He always had a great sense of what the country wanted, and he could communicate very effectively in that sense.
Well, it sounds like they were a good team, and yet
they were a great team. They were a great team.
And yet you also write, and this is, I guess, observing President Reagan on the campaign trail, that he often did better without her while, addressing the public, making some kind of a campaign stop, that he seemed more comfortable without her there beside him.
Well, I say that in the sense that she worried about the little things. He always knew what his job was. His job was to go out and basically communicate his message, and it was his message. It wasn't AIDS message. These are the things he believed in deeply. He was just more relaxed when he was out there without her, in the sense that I'm sure he felt the need to take care of her and to worry about her and to basically get involved in her little idiosyncrasies. And he would usually stay in his compartment with her when on Air Force One, when she traveled with him. When he didn't travel, he'd kind of wander back, talk to the staff. He'd wander back, talk to the press. And it wasn't, he didn't have to worry about her. He could just go out and do what he had to do. I mean, he's a very protective man. They're both very protective of each other. I think they have a marvelous marriage. I think that they love each other deeply, and I think that they always looked out for each other. She worried more, and that's, you know, and I can just simply say that I wouldn't want to be married to Nancy Reagan, but I certainly think any man that had a wife who was as supportive as she was and as protective, particularly in the political environment, does pretty well.
Well, Ed Rollins is our guest today, and Republican campaign manager, political consultant, and author of a book called Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms, written with Tom DeFrank. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest today is Ed Rollins, and his book is called Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms, and it's about his several decades working campaign politics. Well, I know you've worked with many different politicians, presidents like Ronald Reagan and others as well. If you're working with a new candidate, someone that you've just been hired on to do, do you want to know everything about them? Are you sort of a mixture between their priest, their confessor, and their lawyer?
I always tell them that I mean, you've got to trust me. You know, I've been through this battle before hundreds of times. You haven't, and no matter how tough you think this is, it's going to turn out to be tougher. And so I do. I literally say to candidates, pretend I'm your priest. You tell me everything, and I'll tell you whether the sin is mortal or venial, whether we have to worry about it or not worry about it. And most people don't want to tell you the things. They think it's never going to come out. In modern-day campaigns, everything comes out. And I think the reality is that if you're prepared for it, it's not that you get penalized. You get penalized if you're not prepared for it. You can live through just about anything today in the course of a campaign, but you sometimes want to get things out earlier than wait for your opponent to do. Your opponent always wants to bring it out in the closing days of a campaign, so that's what you focus on or get distracted by. Illegal nannies is a topic that did in the Huffingtons. If they would have been honest with me and told me they had an illegal nanny, I would have taken that out in June, not in November, and basically done a mea culpa, say, listen, it's a complicated problem. We had this woman who worked with my children. She wasn't illegal, and I feel badly about it, but so be it. Then you've got 3 or 4 months, and it goes by. But in his particular case, he denied that they had illegal nannies. The other side knew that he had illegal nannies. They timed it in a way that when he came out in support of a major anti-immigration statewide proposition, 187, they came out 2 days later and said, well, he says he's against illegals getting aid and what have you, but he has an illegal on his staff. He denied it initially, and then it became clear. And by then, he had no credibility on any issue, and people thought of him as a hypocrite, where if he would have said, listen, it's a complicated issue. I've had my own problems with it, but at the same time, I still think this is an important issue for voters. Voters would have taken him in a different perspective. Christy Whitman, in the race that I managed, she had illegal nannies. It came out at the same time that Zoe Baird and Kimba Wood were up to be attorney general. A lot of debate about nannies. We took it out. We were very honest about it. And it never was an issue after that. But you know, if you don't get the stuff out in a way and inoculate yourself, you can get clobbered. And everything that comes out in the closing days of a campaign has an impact. Things that come out early in a campaign often don't have impact.
So confess early.
Confess early and basically be prepared. I can go always prepare. A response if I know about it. And one of the things I always do in a campaign as a strategist, having been around hundreds and hundreds of campaigns over the years, I think I've seen just about everything. I know how to run a campaign against my side, and I always prepare a campaign by saying, all right, now if I was on the other side, how would I run the campaign against me? What are my vulnerabilities? And then I put as tough a campaign together against me, and then I go out and I inoculate and get prepared for it. I mean, a perfect example is today. The Clinton White House is a superb campaign machine. The president's a great campaigner. they are so prepared for everything Bob Dole is going to do that before Bob Dole does it, they have the responses already in the can. They were all prepared for his economic plan. They knew whatever he came out with, they were prepared to go out and get their response. They have tested commercials. They are prepared that whatever he says, they're prepared to counter it, which is what makes for a great campaign.
What do you do on Election Day?
Election Day is the worst day of all because there's nothing for you to do. Right. The game is over. And, you go through a long year period in which you don't have enough hours to do all the things you have to do. And then you get to Election Day and you spend the entire day second-guessing everything that you have done. And you clearly don't know the results till very late that night. It's just a long, miserable day. I mean, sometimes some people go play golf, some people go to the movies, you've got to get out the vote operation that usually is all mechanically in place, and so you just sit there and worry all day.
When Ross Perot came on the national scene in 1992, what was it about him, his message, his whole persona, that made you want to sign on?
Well, I was, like many Americans, frustrated with the political process. I thought George Bush, who was the hand-picked heir to Ronald Reagan, had blown it, had sort of forgotten a lot of the things that had been handed off to him by Reagan. And I didn't think he was going to win. I clearly thought early on in the election season that the country had made up its mind it was going to look for an alternative. I also felt the Democratic Party was not offering a very significant alternative in Bill Clinton at that time. And I think, like a lot of Americans, Perot was attractive. He jumped into the game. He offered something, an exciting look at politics. From my perspective as a professional, it was not a smart choice to make. I had certainly had made my marks in the Republican Party, and for me to walk away from the party clearly indicated a frustration with the party. And I go back to the point that I really was a Reagan Republican, not a moderate Republican, and I think Bush was pretty much a moderate Republican. So I thought Perot would offer. I didn't think he was going to win. I didn't think he was electable. But I did think the dialogue and the debate would be very positive for the country, and I did think the opportunity of a strong independent movement would force the two parties to really define themselves a lot better.
Republican strategist Ed Rollins has just written a book that looks back over his years in national politics called Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms. We'll continue our conversation about Ross Perot in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on Fresh Air, Ed Rollins on why he and Ross Perot parted ways in the 1992 presidential campaign. Also, Rollins talks about what he now maintains were just rumors about alleged payoffs to black ministers during a New Jersey gubernatorial campaign, and the story of Obsession and Devotion, a Seattle band and its number one fan. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's continue our conversation with Ed Rollins. For 30 years, he managed political campaigns for Republicans, including Ronald Reagan and Christine Todd Whitman. His new book, Bare Knuckles and Backrooms, looks back over his years in national politics. The one person he worked with who was not a Republican was Ross Perot, who ran for president in 1992. They had a disastrous relationship. Well, Perot did a background check on you, and in some of your early conversations with you, he had a problem with your beard. Do you think that was a sign of trouble, that he didn't think that, or apparently hadn't worked with people who had a beard? As you look back, do you think that was one of the early signs of there was going to be trouble in this campaign?
There were a lot of idiosyncrasies, and it wasn't that there weren't a lot of warning flags, and being perfectly honest, I mean, as I reflected back when I was writing the book, you know, I wanted in the game. I was at odds with the Bush White House, so clearly I wasn't going to play a role in that campaign. And I can, you know, at the time, my motives may have been, as I stated earlier, to help a reform party, an independent party, to change the system. But, you know, my ego and my pride certainly got involved in it, and that probably forced me to overlook a lot of warning signs. The other part of it is I turned the Perot campaign down two or three times when they made overtures to me. Finally, when I went face-to-face with Perot, he's a great salesman. Now, the guy doesn't have $3 billion in worth because he's not a great salesman. He was in a salesman mode. He was going to do whatever I wanted to do to win. And so I was charmed by him. It quickly changed second, third, fourth week into the campaign when he started being treated like any other candidate, and the going started getting very rough, and he couldn't make the decisions, and he didn't like it anymore. Then that's when a guy like me, I'm like the lifeguard. You know, when you don't need the lifeguard when you're swimming well across the pool. You need the lifeguard when you start to drown. And you know, then you better listen to the person. Perot had a total incapacity to listen to anybody. I mean, he'd always, his, you know, sort of attitude was, it's my money, we do it my way. And the reality, it's, you know, people like myself and who've been tested under fire and know how long a story lasts or know how you basically communicate on the radio or television or in newspapers, you know, are learn from each campaign. Perot, in the end, didn't want to listen, kept saying he didn't want to run a conventional campaign. I kept arguing a conventional campaign is a communication of your message, organizing your supporters, making sure they all are there on election day. You know, each campaign is different in the sense that you alter it, but the same things that I learned 30 years ago, which was find your voters, communicate with your voters, get them to the polls, still are the lessons that he had to practice, and he wasn't willing to do that.
After leaving the Ross Perot campaign, you signed on with Christine Todd Whitman, who was running against incumbent Jim Florio for the governor of New Jersey, and involved with her campaign in the last 5 weeks. This was a family-run campaign. Her brother, her husband were involved. Where were you? How did you fit into this campaign?
Well, first of all, I was with the campaign for over a year. I was the chief strategist. After the primary, Christie's brother came from his ranch in Montana and decided to be the campaign manager. It had always been a family-run business. I mean, she's very close to her husband, very close to her brother. They had run a race against Bill Bradley for the Senate in 1990 and had come very close, a campaign with no money, no resources, what have you. And they didn't understand that campaign wasn't a real campaign in the sense that her vote was sort of an anti-Florio who had raised taxes immediately prior to that, as opposed to a great campaign by her. Because of that, she became the front runner in the gubernatorial race, and I think to a certain extent, under the management of her brother and her husband as her chief advisor, she'd gone from sort of a dead-even race at the end of the primary to where, when I took over the campaign full-time as the campaign manager with 5 weeks to go, she was 21 points behind, badly damaged, really no chance of winning, pretty much written off by the press in the state and by Republicans in the state. We got the campaign focused back on Florio. She was a good candidate. She hung in there. She did not flinch and crawl under the bed like Perot had done in 92. And she, you know, she performed extremely well and in a couple of debates, and the state started looking back on her as a viable alternative again.
Well, it was a hard-fought race, which Christie Todd Whitman did win. A few days later, you were attending a breakfast meeting in Washington, and you bragged that the Whitman administration or the Whitman campaign had spent $500,000 asking black ministers in New Jersey to suppress to stop or reduce activities to get the vote out for the Democratic Party. You said this without any particular evidence. You didn't have names. You didn't have receipts. Why did you say this?
Well, first of all, I didn't brag. I responded to a question at the end of a long breakfast with a group of reporters in Washington. What I said is that we had a better candidate, we had a better organization, we had better television. And someone asked me a follow-on question, and I talked about the organization, and I said the battle in the closing weeks of the campaign were in the urban areas. Florio had not been as effective in the black community as other Democrats had, and Christie had made real outreach efforts. Things happen in politics. I mean, part of the lore of politics is a lot of storytelling that takes place. I had a lot of people say, I'm the ward boss, you get me the walking around money, I'll do X, Y, and Z. Unfortunately, in that breakfast, I repeated some rumors and innuendos. And so instead of saying, I think this is what happened, because I didn't have firsthand knowledge of this happening, but I'd been told some of these things happened. So instead of saying, I think this is what happened, I said, this is what happened. I said it very forcefully. I said it very matter-of-factly. And I have a reputation for having a lot of credibility with media, having been around it for a long time. The story created a firestorm. Clearly, it was a firestorm I could have cleared up the next day by holding a press conference and saying, listen, I should have said, I think, it, I don't know that it happened. I apologize to the ministers because for the simple reason that I don't know that it happened. I think it might have happened, but I don't know that. I couldn't do that because obviously what had occurred is that Christy Whitman, her election was now obviously being contested by the Democrats in the state. The White House, whose team we'd actually beat in that race, James Carville and Mandy Grunwald, and who were running Florio's campaign, became very involved in activating this type of stuff. It was a stupid thing for me to say. I paid a very heavy price for it, both professionally and financially. But it was not a bravado thing. It was a very matter-of-fact, just as I sit here today. It was sort of trying to take a bunch of reporters behind the scenes, and I went, as I said, I should have said, I think, instead of I said, this is what happened. I was tired. It was the end of a long, long campaign season. I was not rested, and I certainly wasn't on top of my game. But I didn't intend on lying. I didn't intend on misleading anybody, but it certainly happened.
Well, I mean, at the time, you were a veteran of campaign politics, and it's hard to believe that you could have been so loose in describing what, or at least making some kind of claim for which you had no backup. And I was wondering whether somehow the race, as you see it, as you saw it then, was between you and James Carville, who was your counterpart in the Florio campaign, that it was really a battle between, quote-unquote, super consultants.
Sure. I make no pretense. That's always a part of the undercurrent. It wasn't something that Carville or I had attempted to do. I mean, the day after the primary, the New York Times talked about the Florio-Whitman battle as the battle of the super consultants. You know, unfortunately, people like myself now have far more profile than sometimes candidates, and we often get too much credit for wins and too much blame for defeats. When in essence, we're just a part of the process. No candidate ever wins by them, or no candidate ever loses by themselves, or ever wins by themselves. But more important, no candidate no consultant is ever the one that really is ultimately responsible. People vote for Christy Whitman, Jim Florio. I think the reality is I was dragged through a very tiring process. I'm not a young man anymore. Campaigning is a young man's sport. I was careless with my words. I was exhausted. I was back working 16, 17-hour days, sleeping in a $44 a night hotel, a block from the campaign headquarters. If I would have walked in there thinking in terms of, gee, strategically, what do I want to say? It was a 55-minute breakfast in which I was back in my commentating role talking about the Gore-Perot debate, and the last question was, a week after the election when nobody in the country cared about the elections that were a week old, was how did you win? It was sort of a courtesy. And I basically rambled on and obviously made a big mistake. People make mistakes, and certainly people like myself who advise others are equally adept at making bigger mistakes than our candidates sometimes.
My guest is Ed Rollins, and his book about his years as a Republican political consultant is called Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our conversation with Ed Rollins. In his book, Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms, he writes about his unfounded claim that walking around money was used to influence the black vote in New Jersey. Well, I know that you apologized to the New Jersey Black Ministries Council. What did you say, and what did they say in response?
Well, obviously, I created a firestorm, and I created a great embarrassment to many African Americans in New Jersey who supported Christy Whitman, many ministers who supported Christy Whitman. It was a front page story across the country. It was a national news story, far more than it probably should have been. So what I said to them in total contrition was that I had made a mistake. I did not in any way, shape, or form mean to cast any aspersions on any of them. A lot of them expressed anger. A lot of them expressed forgiveness. And one of them asked a very telling question. And the telling question was, what do you Republicans think of us, meaning black ministers? And I said, well, unfortunately, too many of us think of you as Democrat operatives, because there are certainly ministers across this country who are politically active. Most are politically active for Democratic candidates. Certainly there are ministers today that are active for Republican. The whole Christian right group is certainly church influenced. But I think the reality is that in the end, the bishop who was presiding said this man came here asking forgiveness, and we will offer the forgiveness. Someone else said to the press as they were leaving that even though we have forgiven Mr. Rollins, because that's what a Christians do, we will not forget. Being perfectly honest, I will never forget. I made, of all the blunders I've made in my political career, this one was inadvertent, but it was severe, and I will always feel terribly, terribly bad about it, because I hurt a lot of innocent people. It's one thing to hurt yourself by your mistakes. It's another thing to hurt others. I hurt Christy, who had just had a great victory and did not deserve to have that victory tarnished. I heard a lot of people who were very supportive of her in the African American community, and I put a little taint on her victory, which was a tremendous victory.
Have you gotten out of the campaign managing because of this incident in New Jersey, feeling perhaps that you were losing touch, or perhaps that you were just spent, that you'd done this and it was time to do something else?
No, actually, I went back because of the financial drain. I had over $100,000 in legal fees. I mean, I was dragged before grand juries and never charged with anything, and there was never any incident of any criminal wrongdoing, but it certainly damaged my business. So I went back and I ran campaigns. I was not going to quit on that and let that be my epitaph. So I went back and I ran campaigns in 1994. And I basically feel now is the time to quit, because I ran the race that beat the Speaker of the House. There's only been one speaker beaten in the last 150 years, so I've now, on my resume, I can say I elected a president and I defeated a speaker, and that's a good place to quit.
Are you going to miss campaigns at all? Are you truly done with this chapter in your life?
I'm done with this chapter in this life. My wife and I adopted a little baby girl from China last summer. She's now 16 months old, and that's my focus. I've had lots of titles in my career, but my title now is I'm Lily's dad, and my focus is going to be on Lily, and I'm doing some constructive things.
Ed Rollins, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Ed Rollins' book about his years as a Republican political consultant is called Bare Knuckles and Back Rooms. This is Fresh Air. From time to time lately, we've been bringing you excerpts from a new public radio program we're excited about called This American Life, which tells stories in a fresh and imaginative way. This American Life is heard on a few dozen public radio stations around the country, and the program is produced and hosted by Ira Glass.
Each week on This American Life, all the stories are organized around some theme. And on this week's show, every story is about someone who loves music, who would die for music, but whose career in music is basically going nowhere, and probably never will go anywhere. All the people in the show are people about whom you could say,
when you talk about music, your face becomes beautiful.
And there's actually something kind of inspiring about that. Anyway, one of the stories in the show is not about a musician, but about a fan. But he's a fan who devotes the kind of energy to fandom that many musicians dedicate to performing. This is the Fastbacks, a pop-punk band from Seattle. It's been around for years, actually. Sarah Vow is a writer and a music critic, and she tells the story of the biggest Fastbacks fan in the world.
Sometimes opening your mail can be a little like listening to the radio. You're not paying attention, just absent-mindedly flipping through the letters and bills, and then wham, some little surprise comes out of nowhere and changes your day. I got this package. Inside was a letter thanking me for mentioning the Fastbacks in a book review I had written. Not from one of the Fastbacks themselves, mind you, just some guy in Chicago. His name was Scott Lee, and he had enclosed this Xerox booklet about the band. Flipping through it, I stopped cold at something called the Fastbacks Drummers Pie Chart. Since they formed in 1979, the Fastbacks have gone through about a dozen drummers, and this pie chart identifies the drummers by name, listing the percentage of songs which each one has contributed to. But at the bottom of the page, small print warns, note, Rusty and Nate's shares may not be totally accurate. Their percentages may be approximately 0.68% off. And I don't think a decimal point had ever struck me as endearing before. The drastic exactitude of 0.68% sort of captured my heart. And I had to meet this person.
Basically, it has your standard discography, and there's just like some facts here that I dug out. 139 total songs, 8 hours, 25 minutes, 43 seconds. Worth of songs.
So he showed me other stats like total recorded versions of songs, total number of seconds of songs, which is 30,343, in case you were wondering.
Shortest song, shortest instrumental song, shortest song with vocals, the longest song, and the longest song without a drum solo. That's only because
I was stunned. I mean, I thought I liked the band. And normally, as a music lover and as a woman, I rail against the mostly male record collector geek habit of reducing rock and roll to baseball card collecting. They flatten out this complex, thrilling thing down to manageable lists of names and titles and dates. But Scott Lee's Fastbacks tribute has the devotional fervor of a medieval illuminated manuscript. The list of facts and figures is so relentless and exact and painstaking that it takes on this liturgical glow, as if the Fastbacks were a religion and Scott Lee its prophet.
But some of the new additions to this, as I ramble here, listed out the songs through A through Z and did the percentages of songs starting with each letter, and the letter that won was I. There were 19 Fastback songs that started with I, representing about 14% of the songs. With every album, they seem to have a song that starts with in, like in America, in the summer, in the winter, in the observatory.
I soon found out that the band has befriended Scott Lee and that they've sort of informally appointed him their de facto archivist. Singer Kim Warnick corresponds with Scott via email, sometimes like four times a day. Guitarist and songwriter Kurt Block graciously calls him a good person to have on our team, though when he first saw Scott Lee's packet, he had some understandable worries.
I was like, boy, that would come to my mind is, this guy really scary? Is he the kind of person I would, run away from if he was ever in the same room? Is this the kind of person that I would stop answering my telephone if he called? And no, it's not. Not to make you think that we don't think Scott Lee is actually fairly crazy of a person, but he's not the annoying kind of crazy person that you read about. And I think he appreciates his own over-the-topness.
If anything, the Fastbacks are a little protective of Scott Lee. When I was talking to Kurt, I jokingly called Scott his stalker, but he set me straight.
No, he's not a stalker. He's a super fan.
Oh, super fan.
Yeah. Okay. Stalker, that has negative connotations. Yeah, that's something we don't need. The super fan is fine.
Like the super fan, the members of the Fastbacks all have day jobs. So on any given day, it's possible that Scott is devoting more energy to being a fan than the Fastbacks devote to being in the band. When I interviewed Kim, the gaping differences between being a band member and being a super fan were never clearer. Okay, so I have a pop quiz for you.
Okay.
How many total songs before the new album, New Mansions and Sound, have the Fastbacks recorded?
What is it now?
How many total songs have the Fastbacks recorded?
You know, unfortunately, I don't have something in front of me that could answer that question.
Really? Okay. I have to say it is 127. And I was wondering also if you knew the median song length.
The what?
Well, let's start with an easier one. What do you think is the average length of a Fastback song? She doesn't know, but according to Scott, it's 2:51. When I visit Scott Lee's house on Chicago's north side, his roommate lets me in. Scott's playing his guitar along with the new Fastbacks album. His room is decorated with Fastbacks posters, and Scott himself wears a Fastbacks t-shirt. He shows me this incredibly complex chart he's working on, a sort of family tree to the Seattle music scene, a town, by the way, which he has only visited once. The producers of This American Life would like me to say here that when Scott talks about the Fastbacks, he becomes beautiful, because that would go along with the first piece in the show today. But I would never say something so corny. When do you think you kind of made the switch between just being a listener and being, as Kurt Block called you today, super fan?
I think the transition really happened when I was in law school, and I had made this tape of my favorite Fastback songs, and I was walking across a very icy, cold midway in Buffalo, and despite how cold it was, when I listened to this music, it really just pumped all this life into me. It was really a life-affirming experience, as corny as that might sound. But I don't know, I was just really happy at that point, and it was like it was just a light on me that shone, and I hadn't seen it before, and now everything seemed better.
I mean, when you show this info packet to people, what is usually their reaction?
They wonder, I think the first question I always hear is, do you have a lot of spare time?
In fact, Scott's spare time is limited. He holds down a full-time job at a Chicago advertising agency, and he writes his own songs. And truthfully, he flirts with the idea of not staying a fan. He's moving to Seattle, partly to be closer to the Fastbacks. He's actually in their circle of friends now. And he's tried a couple of times to start his own band. Once, he was invited on stage with Kurt to play along with the song. It was exciting, but he's left-handed, and they didn't have a left-handed guitar for him, so it was sort of a disaster, not the moment a superfan dreams of. So on this show, what happens is someone tells their little story, and then we play a song. So you get to pick which Fastback song gets to play at the end of your story.
At the end of my story. I'd probably say Save Room for Me, then. Because I've definitely saved room for the Fastbacks. So Save Room for Me.
Sarah Vowell is a music columnist for the San Francisco Weekly and the author of a book about radio that'll be out in the fall called Radio On, A Listener's Diary. This American Life is produced by Ira Glass at WBEZ in Chicago. Fresh Air's engineers this week are Audrey Bentham and Dan Lachlan, assistants from Phoebe Van Scoy. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, The Nature of Work, we'll hear from Rivethead from the film Roger and Me. Writer Ben Hamper spent 11 years on the GM assembly line. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Levine on his book, What is Work? I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.